Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, and co-parents of all ages, this podcast is for you. Introducing in the center ring, the amicable divorce expert, Judith Weigel.
When I was with the circus, we didn't really have comedians, but we did have acts that were really funny. We had clown acts. Of course, they're supposed to make you laugh. We had me as the dancing bear, and I'm pretty sure I made people laugh. But then we also had humor that wasn't intended to be humor. So for instance, because being the bear wasn't enough for me, I volunteered to dress the poodles. And if I made a wardrobe mistake, little worse than Janet Jackson's at the Super Bowl, of course, the audience would laugh. Of course, the poodle trainer wouldn't laugh, but the audience would laugh. And that's all that's important, right? Well, today we actually have a comedian, but a comedian with a message that's so important to you going through divorce if you're divorcing somebody with a mental illness. You're going to hear a story that will be inspiring, enlightening, and hopefully helpful moving forward. We have Frank King. Frank, welcome.
Thank you. And it also may be triggering. We're going to talk about some things that are difficult, may bring up strong emotions. So just be aware, you know, we're going to be talking mental health, depression, thoughts of suicide. So don't want anybody to, you know, go screaming from a room.
No, but these are really important. So let me just tell people a little bit more of your background, though, so we can position this as we start. So Frank has been a professional stand-up comedian for 8 million years, for 20 years, and he looks fabulous. For 20 years, he was a writer for The Tonight Show, which is an enormous credit beyond belief. 33 years as a corporate comedian, syndicated humor columnist, and podcast personality on many other podcasts besides mine, who was featured on CNN's Business Unusual. Frank talks about depression and suicide. I met Frank because he's a TEDx speaker and he's a coach for TEDx speakers. And as I got to know him, because I also wanted to avail myself of a TEDx talk and he comes highly recommended, I got to learn more about him, and that's why I thought we really do have to hook Frank up with all of you, because I think this is going to be an extra special episode. So without further ado, Frank, I want to do this in two parts. I want to do your backstory first. Okay. I want to talk about how you grew up, and then we're going to go into when you saw signs of depression. And then I want to move this into divorce and mental illness. So let's start with, give us a little bit of your background. Divorced parents, not divorced parents, what was going on?
No, not divorced parents. My folks they met in high school, crazy about one another. Both desperately wanted a family. Both were gay. And so
Okay, so we stop right here a second. These were male and female.
Yes.
Not two lesbians or two gay men.
No.
Okay. No. So could you explain that a little bit? That's important. How did that work?
It was North Carolina. Well, we've got diagrams later to show you how that works. It's the late 1930s, North Carolina. They're both gay. They're crazy about one another, both smart and funny, both wanted a family. And back then, people didn't come screaming out of the closet in North Carolina. Actually, they probably don't do that today, but certainly back in the late 30s, early 40s, that wasn't a thing. And so they decided to get married, and they were going to adopt, but there weren't many infants available. So they decided to have children the old-fashioned way. And one of the reasons that I'm still on the planet and I'm still here and in my life, which you'll hear about later, is that my mother got pregnant, carried it to term, and it passed away shortly after birth. A year later, she decided to get pregnant again. She carried it 9 months and it died shortly after birth. Where she found the courage to try a third time, and I was born the fourth time my sister was born, I have no idea. So my feeling is that I stick around and I don't end my life because my mother was so brave and worked so hard. I have to be at least as brave and work at least as hard to stick around until my appointed time.
I'm just processing this again. So in your household, did they get along?
Oh, yeah. And like any married couple, they bickered occasionally. There's a famous family story where my mom got mad at my dad about something and they were romping around the house. And I guess when my dad did something that made my mom mad, the way they made up was they had Chinese food. And so the phone rang in the middle of all this and I picked it up and whoever was on the other end said, "How are things?" And I said, "Big fight, Chinese food tonight."
And it wasn't a Chinese restaurant delivering, was it?
No, in Raleigh, North Carolina, we had one Chinese family and one Chinese restaurant.
Thank God they could cook.
Yes, Lord. The Cantons. And so they were happy. My mother's siblings married miserably and all lived into their 80s and all were miserable the entire time they were married. But that generation, my mother's generation, all the times in for a penny, in for a pound, they didn't get divorced. So, but my mom and dad very happy until my dad passed away at the age of 40.
That's young. That's young.
It seemed old when I was 8 years old and he passed away. When I sailed through 40, it seemed really young. Now at 65, it seems incredibly young.
Frank, hold on a second though. I'm still stuck on they were both gay, and yes, at that time, God forbid, nobody really talked about it, and you lived the life of a heterosexual if you could. Did they not resent one another? You didn't get any of that. They really made this work.
Yes, they didn't have other interests as far as I know, romantic interests. My mother never was with another man after my dad died. She was with, she had a lesbian friend, but... they were a happy couple.
How did you know they were gay? When did you know they were gay?
I didn't know they were gay until after my mother passed away. Years after. She passed away in 87, and it would have been in the 2005-06-07 time frame.
How did you find out?
Well, my wife and I were walking the dogs one day, and my wife said, "I got a question for you. When your mom was winding down the hospital with cancer, everybody who came to see her was a lesbian." I said, "Yeah, those are her friends." And she said, well, "Did your mom have a special friend among those folks?" "Oh, yes," I said. Miss Cheek." "Oh," my wife said, as she leads me down the primrose path. She says, "Well, did Miss Cheek ever come over and, spend the night?" "Oh, yes, she came over every Wednesday and spent the night." I still haven't figured it out at this point.
Wow.
You're a kid. You just accept things as they are.
Right.
So she said, "Well, when she came over on Wednesday nights, when did she sleep?" And I went, "In my." It all fell into place at that moment.
Wow. Yes. Okay.
And my dad was a window dresser in a clothing store, and if three button suits were in one year and it was two button the next, he would give all the three button suits to Goodwill and he would wear the two button suit because he was, he was into fashion, and he did everything but leave me a crate of Judy Garland records to let me know he was gay. But they wanted a family and they ended up doing it the old fashioned way. And I'm sure the neighbors had some idea, maybe.
I'm so impressed. I'm so impressed that they did this in a good way. Okay.
There's a final story that goes with that.
Go ahead.
Don't take my word for it. Ask your mom's friend Audrey, who's the only person in that group still alive. So back in North Carolina, I had lunch with Audrey, and I said, "Look, Audrey, nobody cares about this but you and me, and we're you, me, and my sister, the only ones left alive. And if you don't want to answer this question, don't answer." I said to Audrey, "Was my mom gay?" And Audrey, at 84 years old, goes, "Duh."
Oh, my heavens. Oh, my. You know, this is just so interesting. In the film, The Bridges of Madison County, I thought that was really interesting that we kind of start with the two kids going through the memoirs of the Meryl Streep character and then working back and putting the whole story together. And no, we don't really understand what's going on in our households when we're growing up. But how did you process that? How did you look at your parents after you found out the reality of their lives and the commitment they made to one another?
It made them far more fascinating that they went through all that, you know, against nature, losing two children at birth, you know, having the courage to go on and try again. And I realized that my mom's friends, most of them nurses, because she gave state boards in North Carolina. I have a keynote called "Everything I Need to Know I Learned from a Lesbian."
That's because
it's true.
Your mom.
I learned how to operate a lawnmower and pitch a tent and change a tire and cut up my steak and go and fish from all her friends. And the keynote has another name for the corporate world. "Everything I Need to Know I Learned from a Nurse," because they're all nurses. And I speak to nurses oftentimes. It did an opening keynote for the National Association of Orthopedic Nurses. My job was to remind them why they became nurses and encourage them to remain in the profession. So I tell my story about all my mom's friends, all the nurses. I say, look, they say it takes an ability to raise a child. Give me a couple of shifts of good nurses and we can get the job done. And as I'm talking about the nurses being at every Pop Warner football game, every recital, every spelling bee, every holiday, they were there with us, you know, helping because my mom was a single mom. Now, at this point in my keynote, I'm crying. The nurses are crying, you know, remembering why they went into the profession. I said, because that's what nurses do.
Wow. Yeah. So. Yeah, no, this is great. I have to say that I've watched your speeches several times over on YouTube, and I just love them. I find them inspiring. They're so educational because we all have people in our lives that suffer from depression and mental illness. And you said that it runs in your family. So before we get to you, who else?
Well, my grandmother died by suicide. My mother found her. My great aunt died by suicide. My mother and I found her. I was 4 years old. I screamed for days.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I'll spare you the tale. It's in my first TEDx talk called "A Matter of Laugh," L-A-U-G-H, or death, "A Matter of Laugh or Death." I talk about how we discovered the body.
Yeah, I love that title, but oh my Lord.
It was horrifying. Yeah. It's horror movie horrifying. Yeah. And it's called generational depression and suicide. I mean, there are more nuts in my family than in a squirrel turd. There's one cousin who got neither the high cholesterol or the mental illness. He dodged both bullets. We have no idea how. Pretty much everybody else is on Crestor and some kind of psychotrope. So it's just, but the upside of that is, the good news is, everybody in the family is funny. So it's, you know, it's got to take the bad with the good.
Frank, when did you notice that in you? And it's depression for the most part, right? And thoughts of suicide?
Yes, I have major depressive disorder and chronic suicidal ideation, which means for me and people in my tribe, the option of suicide is always on the menu as a solution, problems large and small. And when I tell the audience small, my car broke down a couple of years ago. I had three thoughts unbidden: get it fixed, buy a new one, or I could just kill myself. That's chronic suicidal ideation. And the upside of that is, every speech I've given since 2014, there's been at least one person in the audience, sometimes more, who have chronic suicidal ideation, didn't know it had a name, thought they were just some kind of freak, completely alone. I had a young woman come up at a college show and say, "Thanks for your keynotes. You're welcome." She said, "But I got to tell you, it made me weep." "How did it make you weep?" She goes, "Well, you know your story about your car, you know, get it fixed, buy a new one, or just kill yourself." She goes, "I've been having those thoughts all my life. I thought it was just me. I thought, you know, I didn't know it had a name. I thought I was some kind of freak and all alone. And I heard you say that out loud and realized for the first time in my life that I am not in fact alone." And I wept. So that's the upside of that particular ailment.
Okay. When did you notice it though in yourself?
I think I was depressed in college, but chalked it up to the fact that I was going to UNC Chapel Hill and my girlfriend was at the University of Arizona. So we were, you know, high school boyfriend, girlfriend, then separated. So I just thought I was lovesick or, you know, heart sick or whatever.
Okay.
But I didn't realize I was depressed until I married that woman. Wonderful woman, but just not for me. We had no business getting married. And I realized I was depressed and suicidal. And that if I didn't do what I thought I was born to do, what I had decided I was going to do in the fourth grade, stand-up comedy, I was going to kill myself sooner rather than later. And my second thought was, well, wait a minute. I could divorce my wife, quit my insurance job, try stand-up comedy. If it works, great. If it doesn't, I could still kill myself. And like most mentally ill people, I figured that was just me. Nobody else ever had those thoughts. And I've since met half a dozen entrepreneurs, comedians, entertainers, same thought process, living a life they knew wasn't where they belong, being who they knew they weren't supposed to be, and realize if I don't fix this, I'm going to kill myself. So what have I got to lose? I'll give it a shot.
Understood. So you got married, shouldn't have. We all do. So many of us do that. You just take for granted that, well, I've known this person for so long. We really get along. I really don't have anybody else that I've been attracted to. So, of course, the next logical step is getting married, right?
Yes. And I have a bit in my act. Don't always do it, but depending on the audience, about how I knew going down the aisle, I shouldn't get married. I knew intuition was screaming, you shouldn't be getting married. But we dated all through high school. We made the long distance romance, 4 years of college, work against all odds. She moved back to North Carolina where I was living and said to me, look, we're too old to keep dating. We were all of 22. I'm not going to live with you, which would have been my choice, at least with an option to buy. So marry me or I'm going to move on. And
sounds normal. I mean, this sounds rather familiar, right?
I thought nobody else in the world ever had, you know, that sort of those thoughts and that happened to them. But when I tell the story on stage, oftentimes people come up afterwards and go, oh man, that was me. My high school, whatever, you know, it's like an inertia, you know, you're sort of slowly but surely rolling toward the altar.
Yeah.
So, and people would ask, well, you were engaged for a year almost. Why didn't you, back out? Well, number one, once you get engaged, time seems to pick up speed. No sooner have you said okay to marriage, the gifts are coming in, the guests are arriving from out of town, you're walking down the aisle, you know, and next thing you know, you're standing in front of the guy with his collar on backwards saying, do you take this lovely woman? And in my mouth said, I do. My brain said, I'll try. And of course, I learned in short order that you don't try marriage. You try Grape Nuts for a couple of weeks. Try Sports Illustrated for a month. It doesn't work out right. Cancel across the bill. Marriage didn't like that. Although in my act, I say I think it should be like that. I think every marriage should be the same as a combination of the Sports Illustrated offer and furniture store financing 90 days, same as cash. Marriage should be 90 days, same as single. If either one of you wake up or sober up sometime in the first 90 days and realize, oh, dear God, this is a mistake, should be able to write, cancel across a marriage license and keep the gifts.
No, I completely agree with you because I was married for 8 years, very amicably divorced. But I knew going on the wedding day, I didn't feel right. I didn't understand. Are you supposed to be really nervous? Are you supposed to feel ill? I didn't think so, but who knew, right? I also have been of the opinion, and you're kind of endorsing it, that the wedding, the honeymoon is the tell-all. You gave it 90 days. I gave it the honeymoon. That, to me, is the dividing line. Either things get exponentially better or your stomach really doesn't feel good.
Well, my wife and I, first wife and I, were both virgins at the altar. And so we didn't seal the deal on our wedding. Just fumbled around for a while and went to sleep. I can't even remember when we, you know, did
actually consummated.
Yeah. And I think I was resistant to it because it's a form of commitment.
Ah.
And God forbid she would get pregnant. you know.
Interesting.
Fortunately, she never did. Although I have a joke in my act that I bought from an attorney for a quarter.
Because they are very funny people. Well, yes.
I was working with Brett Butler.
At our expense.
Yes, I was working with Brett Butler, who, Southern female comic. She had a show called Grace Under Fire or something.
I remember.
And she's gotten some acting roles since, and terrible substance abuse disorder, but I think she's in recovery. Anyway, I'm standing there talking to her, an attorney friend of hers, and he says, I never should have gotten married. And I said, why not? And he said, well, we had nothing in common, my ex-wife and I. But you know what they say, Frank, opposites attract. She was pregnant and I wasn't. And I said, did you write that? And he goes, yes. I said, can I buy it? He said, yes, give me a quarter for it. Best money ever spent on a joke.
It's really good.
Yes.
Thank you for that. And your divorce was amicable, right? Yeah, that you were telling me when we were talking.
Yes, we got separated a couple times, and then we were at the beach together with the folks, walking the beach, and I said, you know, I just couldn't pull the trigger to end it. So probably a bad metaphor for me, but anyway, I said, well, we'll get back together. I'll just do mic nights. You know, I'll continue selling insurance. And she says, no. You're lying to me and you're lying to yourself. You want to be a comic since fourth grade. You need to do that. I'll move to Seattle with my folks because that's where our folks were living at the time. And just, reboot my life, restart my life. And you go be a comic. And which was a great favor. She kicked me to the curb, which I couldn't seem to pull off. The second favor she did for me, the next thing out of her mouth was, but I've seen your act. You don't have what it takes. So she not only cut me loose, she motivated me. You know, the I'll show you attitude.
Right.
That drove me for years. I'll show you I can make a living at this. So, but it was kind of her to end the marriage. Because I just didn't have the wherewithal to. Knew it should be done, but couldn't seem to make it happen. So anyway, she ended up marrying a fellow who lived on Mercer Island, which is where all the Microsoft millionaires live. So I hope she married well. And she had a couple of kids by all reports. That's exactly what she wanted. I'm thrilled she got it.
And you are now in a 34-year marriage. Am I right?
Yep. We just had our anniversary, 34 years. We were married on the 4th of July.
Yay.
A number of reasons. One, that was our family reunion every other year.
Oh, right.
And so we thought, well, why not do it when everybody's going to be there anyway so they don't have to fly in special for a wedding? The comedy club owner was a friend from childhood, so he booked me that week. He always booked me that week knowing that's when we had the family reunion. My wife would tell you that I chose July 4th because it's Independence Day and I can't resist the irony. And she said she picked July 4th because she wanted to be guaranteed fireworks on her wedding night.
Aww.
And we got married in the backyard of my cousin's house over a North Carolina barbecue. And I did three shows that night at the comedy club.
Well, now we go to your exceptional career in comedy, writing for The Tonight Show, writing for many other people and situations, but how did you come to deciding on this speech about depression and suicide prevention?
Well, I started as a comic day after Christmas, 1985. Asked my girlfriend, now my wife of 34 years, if she wanted to come along for the ride, thinking she'd say, oh, hell no. And she goes, yeah. So we didn't intend to spend 2,629 nights on the road with no home, but that's how it ended up, 7 years and change. And worked with Rosie and Ellen and Dennis Miller and Foxworthy and Ron White and Dana Carvey and, you know, back when they were Seinfeld, back when they were just comics. And I rode that horse until the mid-90s when the comedy club boom busted. Went working radio for about 18 months, took a number one morning show, drove it to number six. One of my proudest accomplishments. Yeah. A friend of mine goes, you didn't drive that into the ground, you drove it to Middle Earth. Of course, I got fired. And by then, the comedy club thing was waning, so my act was very clean. So I got on the rubber chicken circuit doing corporate comedy, which pays better by a factor of 10.
Oh, without a doubt.
Yeah, I mean, it just made sense to me. First mm-hmm. time I got a check for a corporate comedy show that was three times what I would have made a night at a club, I thought, okay, I'm in. And I rode that horse until about the 2007, 2008, when the recession, the last recession hit.
How well business I remember off. That.
Yeah, business dropped off 80% overnight. My lovely wife and I lost everything we'd worked for in 25 years in a Chapter 7 bankruptcy. And that's when I learned what the barrel of my gun tasted like. Spoiler alert, I did not pull the trigger. That usually gets a nervous laugh from my audience. You know, should we be laughing at this?
Well, you are a comedian. You have given us license to laugh at anything you say.
That's because the next thing I say to them is, you know, a friend of mine was in the audience not long ago at a keynote, heard me say I didn't pull the trigger, came up and asked me, and I quote, "Hey, man, how come you didn't pull the trigger?" I go, "Hey, man, could you try to sound slightly less disappointed?"
Okay, some people really aren't funny, Frank.
No, but it gave me a great story to tell. Absolutely. So I always wanted to make a living and a difference. Because once I got in the speaking world, pretty much everybody but me was making a difference somehow. They had content, learning objectives, takeaways. I could never figure out what I had to teach anybody. After the recession, the meeting planners called me and said, "Frank, we love you. We can't pay you that kind of money just to be funny. You got to teach us something." So I thought, oh, dear God, what do I have to teach? Well, I got a book by a woman named Judy Carter called The Message of You, Turning Your Life into a Money-Making Speaking Career. Great subtitle. And I went into the book thinking I got nothing. And it's almost a fill in the blank. She works you through, walks you through. And about halfway through, I thought, I've got something to talk about. Because I looked at my family history of mental illness, my history of mental illness. And I thought, you know, if I got some training in suicide prevention, I could teach that as a keynote. So I took two classes, one on suicide as a workplace health and safety issue, one on, the protocol, how do you handle somebody who's depressed? How do you know? Suicidal, how do you know? And the last piece of the puzzle was, how am I going to rebrand from a funny speaker to a speaker who's funny? And that's the way Judy Carter expresses it. You want to go from being a funny speaker to a speaker who's funny. And my lovely wife said, "We'll do a TED Talk." And I famously said, "What's a TED Talk?" She showed me what it was, and I happened to get an application in the mail that week from a TEDx talk in Vancouver, British Columbia. Said, would you be willing to apply?" Sure. So I applied. I got the audition. I flew up from Eugene, Oregon to Vancouver, BC, and auditioned live and got the TED Talk. And that was the beginning of my rebranding. And nobody in my family, I'm 58 at this point, nobody in my family, my friends, my wife, nobody knew that I was depressed and suicidal until I went out on that TEDx stage and I revealed that I came out on the stage that day in that TEDx.
Oh my.
Yeah. So when my wife was about to push play, when it made it to YouTube, I said, "Wait, don't hit play yet. There's probably half a dozen things I need to tell you that you don't know about me that I don't want you to learn watching the video." So I told her that I was, you know, living with depression and suicide and how close I'd come and so forth and so on. And that allowed me, I did that TEDx very serious, some very dark humor in that TEDx as well.
Oh, I know. I mean, I've watched it several times, but you have two or three videos that I found easily and I've watched them several times and I really have enjoyed them. Frank, when you did the audition, that was before 2007, 2008?
No, I auditioned in 2014.
Okay, so here's what I want to ask, and this is where I'm going to pivot into mental illness and divorce.
Okay.
So in 2007, 2008, you declared bankruptcy, and the barrel of the gun comes out.
Yep.
And at that point, Wendy, your current wife, still didn't know about mental illness and depression and suicidal thoughts.
Didn't I mean, you know, she knew I was grumpy and moody at times, but I don't think she connected it with depression and thoughts of suicide.
And you didn't clearly have this talk with her defining what's going on inside of you.
No, not until she was about to watch the YouTube video in 2014.
May I ask why not?
Like a lot of people with mental illness, just don't tell anybody. I don't want to burden people with the news, because oftentimes you figure there's nothing they can do for you. It's not going to make you feel any better. It's going to make them feel worse. It's a mistake. Now, I encourage people to come out, as it were, to people they know, love, and trust, so that when they get into a bind, you know, when they're cycling down, perhaps suicidal, that everybody knows what they're going through and everybody is standing ready to help out.
Right.
So, yeah, I should not have waited that long. She should have known. Because it makes it a lot easier if your spouse or loved ones know.
It does. You know, I was just having a conversation. I was a guest on somebody else's podcast yesterday. And I was saying there is an episode in Sex and the City where Carrie Bradshaw, played by Sarah Jessica Parker, talks about your silent secret self. And we all have a silent secret self. And I was saying that I think even in the best marriages, just as a form of self-protection, I don't think we can and then do express everything, every one of our thoughts to our spouse. Do you concur with that?
Well, I think important thoughts like I'm depressed and suicidal, you know, I think you pick and choose. You know?
Right.
Yeah. And I should have told her long, long before. Well, and here's an example of why. Now, if I tell her, look, I'm depressed, I'm cycling down, then if she sees a scowl on my face, she doesn't take it personally or think it's something she did, which is, you know, is only fair to her.
Right.
Secondly, since she's got a wicked sense of humor, I said to her one day, you know, one of my triggers for my depression is disappointing you. So she sits on that, waits for the right moment. I did something stupid, and I said to her, are you mad at me? She goes, no, I'm not mad. I'm disappointed. So we can, you know, laugh about it, and, you know.
That's really great. That's really great. All right, now, as we're going now into mental illness and divorce, I want to just focus on one thing,
okay.
And that is the bankruptcy and everything that you had to both go through 2007, 2008, and why that didn't cause a divorce, which is normal.
Well, I think we would agree that the bankruptcy is the kind of thing that either drives you apart or drives you closer together. And in our case, fortunately, it drove us, I mean, as bad as the feelings were, I felt horribly guilty because I was in charge of the money, and you know, it also allows you to drill down to what you need, not what you want.
Mm.
And fortunately, we were able to protect the little house that we live in now. That's pretty much it: house, cars, animals, and clothes. And started from scratch. And I think it made both of us more empathetic. I think somehow deepened our personalities, you know, going through that kind of, you know, situation, and rebuilt together. She went to work full time because she had been a stay at home farm / house mom. We had a kind of a hobby farm outside of a small town in Washington State.
And you have tons of animals, right?
Yes. We have 3 rescued German Shepherds and 10 rescued kitty cats.
Love that.
Yeah,
I got to see 2 of them cross the camera that one day.
And I'm scratching one of them right now because she's demanding attention. So she went to work full time and has been working full time for 10, 11 years. And, you know, to provide income and also to provide us with medical insurance because I've got other medical issues, you know, heart issues that are expensive to fix. So she's worked really hard since then, and our goal is that I turn 65 in November, so I get Medicare, and then she turns 65 in March of 23. She gets Medicare, which means she wouldn't have to work for health insurance. So we're working very hard to get the mortgage paid off before her birthday in 23, so she can work part-time. She can put it all together, come home, be my chief of staff. That's the dream, because I don't care if I ever retire, but I'd like to get her retired. So she could come home and, you know, look after the animals in the house and so forth and so on.
Entertainers do not want to retire. That's their lifeblood, is entertaining, right?
And speakers, you know, it's...
same thing, you're entertaining when you're speaking.
Yeah, well, somebody posted on Facebook, a guy that he posts questions every day, and pretty good ones. And one of them was something about vacations and holidays. you know, when was the last vacation you took? And I just wrote, never, dot, dot, dot. And he wrote, you know, he posted back, never, you don't take, you don't want to take. I'm self-employed. So there really is no weekend or holidays. Just means the bank's closed. And B, because I believe I am who I came here to be and I'm doing what I came here to do, that I don't really feel the need for a vacation. Right? You know, I mean, I've had jobs where I'm working, you know, 9 to 5 Monday through Friday, and weekends are fabulous and vacations are wonderful.
Yeah.
But in what I do now, I just, you know, I don't feel the need to. He said, what about the cruises? I go, well, when I go on a cruise, and I did for 10 years, I did cruise comedy. I'd get on the ship and I'd go right to my cabin, and I pretty much stayed there until time for me to go on and back to my cabin. And all the time I'm on the ship, unlike most entertainers on the ship who are drinking and gambling and cheating on their spouses, I was in my cabin. They called me a cabin rat because I never came out. I was in there working the entire time, whole week, catching up on all the stuff I never had time for at home. So, yeah, I haven't had a vacation. I mean, I've been on a vacation on the boat.
My background is in live entertainment. Divorce is another form of entertainment. It's dark, I have to say. But in actual ticket sales, ticketed entertainment shows, I never thought about a vacation. It just never occurred to me. You just went to work and it was fun, hard work, but fun. And so who cared if you had a few days off? I guess that was the vacation.
And, you know, I travel for a living. On the ships, it was longer, a week, 10 days.
Yeah.
Now it's 2-3 days. But still, I'd rather, my vacation is the staycation, being home with my lovely wife.
Yeah, I know.
My dream is that she's able to retire and that from that point on, she's never more than an arm's length away from me if I'm not flying off somewhere to speak.
That's so sweet. That is. Okay, now, Frank.
Yes.
You're not a therapist, but in your own words, you're a member of the tribe and the tribe of people who share depression and thoughts of suicide. But I'm also going to call you a first responder because I'd like you to comment now on some things I'm going to read because I did a little research.
Uh-oh.
In the field of divorce, I've had, you know, other people on that are credentialed and qualified to talk about personality disorders and certain levels of mental illness. Well, personality disorders are a form of mental illness.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And when I first got into this business 9 years ago, the divorce business, bipolar was the personality disorder du jour. Now it's switched to narcissism.
Yes, Lord.
Yes. And so Bill Eddy, like the international guru of how to deal with personality disorders in divorce, was saying that the personality disorders are reflective of society at any point in time.
Hmm.
And I thought that was interesting because our society has more and more been focused on money. It's all about money. We define ourselves by how much money we make. Well, certainly in Los Angeles, I live in the land of the shallow. So we, you know, definitely that's what is discussed is how much money. And So when I get cases here, I'm not a therapist, I'm not a lawyer, I'm a mediator, a paralegal on steroids, but I have to be aware of who I'm dealing with because I may not be able to deal with everybody. Mm-hmm. There is a point when if any type of mental illness or emotional disorder is in between the discussion and settlement agreement, it makes it extremely difficult. So let me just read a little bit that I pulled out. And that is, hold on, number one. This is from, wait a minute, the National Center for Biotechnology. There are many reasons a couple could decide to file for divorce. According to a multinational study conducted by this Center for Biotechnology, mental illness is one of the reasons. The study found that people with anxiety and depression foremost, and then other affective disorders, record divorce rates higher than the national average. And the national average is 50% of first marriages end in divorce, 60% of second marriages, and 70% of third marriages end in divorce. So if you're a relation-oriented person, you're kind of screwed if you're not completely balanced, right? First responder, tribe member, what do you think?
Well, one, I think I'm a much better second husband than I was at first because, you know, now I've got the teacher's manual with the answers in the back. I don't know if everybody does this, but I believe my first marriage gave me a list of things I knew I did not want in a spouse. My second thought was, well, I should make a list of things I do want. So I actually made a list in my head. I want somebody who's tall, blonde, forgive me, busty, independent, you know, self-reliant, great sense of humor. And 2 days later, I bumped into my now wife in the grocery store, and she's all those things and more. So I think if you take the lessons of the first marriage and you apply them to the second marriage, you might not find yourself in a position to blow the third one.
Right. But if you do what a lot of people do and say, but it's all your fault.
Yes.
It's the blaming. It's not looking inside. It's not taking into account. So I see that as you taking the responsibility for your own decision.
Yes.
And now want to correct that decision-making. Yes?
Yes, and I even have a joke in my act about, it really wasn't fair to my first wife because she married an insurance salesman and got a comedian. It was a matrimonial bait and switch. So it really wasn't her fault. And I tried to tell her over pizza in Raleigh, North Carolina before we got married, at Brothers Pizza, that my goal was to be famous. And she, you know, she thought, you know, community theater, you know, a hobby, an avocation. I guess I wasn't forceful enough in my, and I've spoken at the University of North Carolina to their entrepreneurial students. I said, look, here's the deal. If you want to be an entrepreneur, a couple of things you should know, and you won't hear this from anybody else. One, you should tell your girlfriend or boyfriend or whatever, you know, whatever their preferred pronouns are, right now, that you want to be an entrepreneur. That's what you're going to do. So if they're, you know, let them sign on or sign off, but give them the choice up front in advance. When you graduate, move in with your parents and don't buy a new car. Save every dime to put into your whatever you want, business you want to start. So, you know, live small. Make sure that all the people in your life know what you're up to and where you're headed so they can sign on and support you. Because what happened with my first wife was she was four square against comedy. So when I started going to open mic night, she was not only not encouraging, she was actively discouraging.
How do you mean?
Well, she did not like that. That's not what she wanted me to do. So she wouldn't come see a show. She wouldn't ask me how the show went. I couldn't really talk about, you know, a great show, a bad show. When I moved in with my girlfriend, now my second wife, she already knew. She had the advantage of knowing that I was a comedian and that's what I was going to do. So that's, it's kind of like if you're marrying somebody in the military, you got a pretty good idea.
Because what was your pickup line, Frank?
Oh, I saw her in a grocery store and I hustled outside to where she was packing her bike bags with her groceries. I had a business card printed and I just picked them up that day and I wrote this pickup line. It was a business card, said white collar comedy, humor for the pinstripe personality. I gave her the business card and said simply, if you ever need a laugh, give me a call, and walked away.
Love that.
That's pretty good sales pitch in that it's not like, hey, baby, let's go out. It's up to you. Here's my phone number.
It's a great sales pitch. And you know, women love to laugh and they love men that make them laugh.
Yeah, which by the way doesn't explain why Ronald McDonald doesn't have a wife. But anyway, she called the number. Yeah, she called the number thinking it was a joke line, got my old answering machine, left a message with her work number, smart girl. And we made arrangements to go out on the 30th of October in 1984.
Day before Halloween.
Yep. Went to the movies. She's a vegetarian. I took her to a hot dog stand. She doesn't even drink soda pop. So it was dollar movie night. So she, the first date cost me $1. Cheap date. Anyway, what you don't know is that I met her in this grocery store in a tremendously gay neighborhood in San Diego called Hillcrest, largest population of gays outside of the Bay Area in California. And there's lots of female impersonator bars around there, you know, like Lacage bars. Mm-hmm. And she's tall, she's muscular, wearing a ton of makeup, false eyelashes, and I'm just gorgeous. And I began to worry as our, you know, the time.
Well, first of all, your parents, your upbringing, how you were fooled by that.
Yes. And so I'm thinking maybe, you know, maybe she has outdoor, not indoor plumbing. So, because she's way too good looking for me. There's no reason for her to go out with me. The joke I wrote about that years later was, thank God for low self-esteem. Anyway, I said to my roommate, look, if I don't call you by midnight, here's her address. And send the cops, because I'll be playing the crying game and losing. She can take. So at 11:45 that night, I said to her, can I borrow your phone? And she goes, sure. She handed me an old portable phone. And I called my roommate in front of Wendy, my wife now. I simply said, it's a girl.
Too cute.
And of course, I had to explain to her why.
Yeah. Okay, so I don't want to bring this down, but back to mental illness and divorce.
Yes.
So as a first responder and a member of the tribe.
Yes.
I live in California. You're in Oregon. In California, it's a no-fault divorce state. And there's only two boxes you can check for divorce. Oh. Either irreconcilable differences or permanent mental incapacity. And that could take in mental illness to the point where you can't really hold jobs consistently, therefore you can't provide income, you have emotional highs and lows, you don't play well in the sandbox with other employees, you know, all of that stuff. You can't dance in center ring with the other fake animals, maybe in my case. So can you help anybody listening now that is pretty sure they are married to somebody with a personality disorder to the point where it's destructive to a relationship or true mental illness? Is there an Al-Anon? You know, there's Al-Anon family members of alcoholics. How can you help people that are dealing with this in a spouse right now?
Well, several things. There's an outfit called NAMI, National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI. National Alliance. Okay. They have classes. Everything NAMI does is free. They have classes. So if you have a loved one, be it a spouse or a child or whatever, who has a mental illness, you can take a 12-week class, one night a week, and you learn about that illness. So it's sort of like going to Al-Anon and learning about alcoholism. And you learn what to say to the person, what not to say, you know, what to do, what not to do, how to find resources. And I believe it's probably a little bit like Al-Anon, the idea being, look, at some point, you have to decide to save yourself. You know, you have to make the decision that, you know, you've got to get out. I had a woman that I knew at the chamber here in town who had been married to a gentleman with untreated bipolar disorder for a decade. And she'd done everything she possibly could to get him into therapy and get him off beer. And she came up to me and said, I'm leaving my husband, thinking that I would say, oh, no, how could you do that? He's mentally ill. You know, that I would side with him.
Right.
And I said, honey, 10 years is long enough. You've done everything you can. You can't fix him. Save yourself. And within a year, she met somebody wonderful who's, I suppose, relatively sane, and she moved on with her life. So I think at some point you have to, and here's the thing about men. We're writing a series of books on men's mental health. And the guy who did the foreword in our first book created a suicide prevention protocol. And he specialized in suicidal men. And the thing about men and mental illness, according to him, is this. Men don't wake up one morning and go, I think I need to see a psychologist. He said you almost have to corner them. Put them in a corner and say, look, I love you, but I can't put our children through this. So unless you go into therapy, we're going to have to leave, or a job. You know, Bob, if you don't go and talk to HR and find out about our mental health benefits, get evaluated and get into therapy, don't bother coming in Monday morning. You pretty much got to force a guy into a corner to get him to admit and then admit himself to therapy.
That's really good information. Thank you for that. Keep going.
Yeah, I think so. If you're married to somebody, especially a man like that, it may come down to, look, I love you, but I'm just not going to put myself or the kids or whatever through this. I've got to save myself unless you get into therapy. So it's, you know, it's up to you. A little bit of tough love, I guess, but, you know, still
right. I mean,
you're willing to try if you're willing to take responsibility and get into therapy.
Yes.
Beer is medicine over a short period of time. I had friends who had heard voices and things. It'll quiet the voices, but it only works for a short period of time. It's not a long-term, you know, strategy to self-medicate. You need therapy and probably some real medication. So, but I think, you know, you got to save yourself, you know, give it your best shot. And if they refuse to take, you know, to get help, then, you know.
Okay. So are you of the opinion is NAMI, did I say that right?
NAMI.
NAMI. Mm-hmm. And are they of the teaching that in many respects, just having different issues with mental illness isn't game over? It is treatable. Is mm-hmm. that a true statement?
Yes, it's treatable, and suicide is the most preventable cause of death on the planet. But it's all a matter of starting a conversation, whether it's starting a conversation about suicide or whether it's starting a conversation with a therapist about whatever is, you know, your issue. People always ask, what do I do? My so-and-so is depressed. Well, first get a mental health evaluation, find out what kind of depression it is. Is it the depressive side of bipolar disorder? Is it simple, you know, garden variety depression? And then I'd say have a physical. Sometimes physical ailments present as mental health issues. So
can you give me an example?
Guy here in town, it's rare, but a gentleman here in town, a friend of mine, was depressed, terribly depressed, and went and had a physical. And turns out his body could not metabolize iron. And that was throwing his entire system off. So they put him on a time-release iron supplement, and the depression symptoms disappeared.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's rare, but you know that sometimes things going on physically can present as, you know, as
okay. Okay. I'm sorry to interrupt it. Stress. A lot of people, I think that, you know what, it's just stress. I'm sorry, I'm not handling it well. I'll do better. Do you hear that might be the smokescreen for true mental illness or emotional illness?
It's possible. I've been doing podcast appearances, and I've got a keynote called Social Distancing and Staying Sane, Don't Worry So Much About Your Mentally Ill Friends. Because back when everybody was socially distancing, I realized that most of my mentally ill friends are high functioning, have self-care plans and other techniques in place to simply be able to get out of bed in the morning, because we wake up in an uncertain world every day, whether there's a pandemic or not. So we're used to this. So I was, and those skills are transferable. So I was teaching neurotypical people who were probably situationally depressed by the pandemic and being stuck at home with the entire family, that you have to create a self-care plan. And I would teach them my self-care plan and some other techniques for managing, you know, all this in a very uncertain world. Mine is diet, exercise, good night's sleep, meditation, medication are the five items in my self-care plan. Okay. And then I've got some other techniques I use to be able to get out of bed in the morning.
It still affects you on a daily basis. It's not going to go away, is it?
No. People say, can you be cured? No. I mean, you could be cured, I think, of situational depression with the pandemic easing. And a lot of neuronormal people that I talked to said, look, I don't want to get on antidepressants. It was like they thought of some kind of life sentence that you're going to be on for the rest of your life. So no, if you're depressed, take whatever they prescribe. And then when the pandemic eases up and the masks come off, just taper off. And you'll probably never have to use them again. But they'll sustain you right now.
Okay, so my takeaways on this are, unless it's so serious that you literally can't function and dress, bathe, you know, go outside. If it's not that, yes, it's treatable. It has to be acknowledged by both the person who has it and your significant other, whoever that may be. It is not something that can be quietly moved aside because it is real. It's palpable. It's part of the relationship that you have.
Yes, correct. And also organic to me. It runs in my family. It's my DNA. People say, well, you know, again, will you be cured? There isn't a cure, although psilocybin, the psychoactive ingredient in magic mushrooms, actually, early studies show that it may be not a fix. I'm sorry, not a patch, but a fix. It may rearrange things in your brain. So it actually may help in the way of a fix for depression. We'll see.
Okay. And that talk, I think for me, just because I'm a mediator and I deal in conversation all the time, just the initiation of that talk has got to be as hard as the initiation for the talk for divorce.
Most people don't get the opportunity to go on stage at a TED Talk and come out as depressed. Hey, by the way, honey, I'm depressed and suicidal. I should have told you that before I got up here.
Let me share this talk I just listened to with this guy, Frank King.
Yeah, well, and you know what? With couples, we have a couple in the chamber, husband, said to me, I was introduced, speaking on a whole different topic, networking, a networking keynote. But I was introduced as a mental health comedian. So he came up and asked me about that. I said, well, I speak on, you know, suicide, the depression, and so forth and so on. And he said, well, my wife, you know, she's a stay-at-home mom. She's somewhat isolated. She's on medication, not working that well. I said, well, do this. You guys sit down together and watch my first TEDx. It'll give you a better idea of what's going through her head. And so they did. And he's watching her watching me. And when it got done, she said to him, I can't believe he did that. She goes, I had no idea that people spoke out loud about these things, much less spoke out loud on stage and has 57,000 views. So it was an epiphany for her. And she joined our, right before the COVID, we had what I call the crazy coffee clatch. Half a dozen people in town, all have one issue or another, get together at this coffee shop, take off our game faces, and just be ourselves, be our mentally ill selves for an hour. You know, it was really dark. And if you overheard the conversation, you'd be horrified. You know, we jumped off a 5-story building. Are you kidding me? 5 stories? No, it'd be at least 10 for me. I'm not taking it. You can walk away from 5 stories. And the people who overheard are like. And then when the hour's up, we put our game faces back on and went out and, you know, walked through the world like nothing was wrong, as we do most days. So. Yeah, it's
so it has to be discussed. It has to be addressed.
Yeah.
You cannot live in embarrassment because way too many people are affected by this, aren't they?
Yes, and that's my job is to start. My clients tell me all the time, we just brought you in here to start the conversation because once I open up, once I mention the words depression and suicide, pretty much everybody's got a story.
Either about themselves or somebody they know.
Yes, I was at an American Association of Suicidology. I did a breakout. And the woman who was doing the breakout before me said, okay, now what I want you to do is stand up if you live with mental illness. Okay, stay standing. Okay, now stand up if you live with somebody who's living with mental illness. Now stay standing. Stand up if you had thoughts of suicide. Okay, stand up if you're a suicide loss survivor or you have a friend or family member who has had thoughts of suicide. And then the next slide on the screen comes up. In parentheses, it simply says, pretty much everybody in the room should be standing at this point. And sure enough, 95% of the people in the room are standing.
Yeah.
Because they know somebody, they are somebody, they live with somebody, they love somebody that has one of these issues.
Right. So. Well, I kind of think that if people just went online, and we're going to let people know how to get in touch with you now, Frank. I just think if people go online and start watching your speeches, I think that's just an excellent conversation opener, because this has got to be one of the more difficult conversations to have either way. The one who has afflicted and the one who's living with the afflicted person. So, Frank, how do people get in touch with you, and for what reasons would they get in touch with you?
Well, they call the U.S. Marshal Service because I'm in the Witness Protection Program. So I've got a website, thementalhealthcomedian.com, thementalhealthcomedian.com. If you go there and put in an email address, I recorded I voiced the first book in our 4-book series on men's mental health, and the MP3 is on there for free.
So start that back again. Where do we find, is it out yet? When's it going to come out?
TheMentalHealthComedian.com. We have a 4-book series on men's mental health. 3 of them are available on Amazon right now. 4th one comes out in September. I'm going to voice them all, but I finished the first one and it's up on Audible, but it's also an MP3 on my site you have for free. It's just a basic book on men's mental health. More women, by the way, buy it than men. And we believe it's because they have a man in their life they just cannot figure out how to help.
So, Frank, do you think more men suffer from mental illness than women, or has there been a study on that by chance?
Women attempt 3 times as often as men. Men tend to complete because they use a firearm.
Women attempt suicide 3 times more than men, but men are more successful because they actually use a firearm.
Yep.
Wow.
Okay. 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal in the U.S., 8 out of 10 suicides in the U.S. as of now are men. So, again, they complete more often. The more women attempt, the more men complete. And part of the reason men die by suicide is they don't tend to share their feelings.
Mm.
Nowadays, they call it male toxicity or masculine toxicity. Back when I was growing up in the South, it was big boys don't cry.
Right.
Toxic masculinity, big boys don't cry. So that's one of the reasons we wrote the books, because 8 out of 10, now here's the good news, Judith. 8 out of 10 people who are suicidal of either sex, 8 out of 10 are ambivalent. Don't know whether they really want to do it or not. And 9 out of 10 who are suicidal give hints in the last 7 days leading up to the suicide. So that tells me the vast majority of people are A, ambivalent, and B, dropping hints. They want somebody to say something and interrupt. And what I teach is, how do you know they're depressed? How do you know they're having thoughts of suicide? What do you do? What do you say? So,
okay, that is so excellent to know. Thank you. Thank you. Frank, this has been an enjoyable time. I really appreciate that you have given your time to us on this extremely important topic of life and death.
Yep.
So thank you. And thank all of you for listening. I appreciate every one of you. I hope this has been a game changer for any of you dealing with mental illness or living with somebody with mental illness. As always, please send me your comments through my website, theamicabledivorceexpert.com. And without a doubt, have an amicable day.
That's our show for today. Thank you for joining us. Be good to yourselves, be kind to your spouse, and cherish your children above all else.